Hello and welcome to the 14th edition of the Pull the Trigger podcast. I am your host, Trigger, and with me are two members of Trash Rocket, Hodge and Craig. Monster is on assignment again. Apparently this operation is called Operation Good Mom, so I guess we have to let her have that. We'll let her be a good mom and all that good stuff. Yeah. If you notice that my voice is kind of shot, I was at a show last night, and some band was playing.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, I'm just a little bit shot. Guess we should start by first saying happy Record Store Day to all those who celebrate. We get to celebrate starting November here in Fredericksburg. Pretty excited about that. That'll be at Bum Rush Vinyl Shop. We're already starting to figure out the ticketing and all of that good stuff to figure out a way. So if people want to get something, you can come in and get like one or two things. So everybody who wants something can at least walk out with one of the things they wanted to buy instead of having a scalper coming in and buying like 50 of the things.
I mean, the state does that with ABC, so I didn't want to hear it. Anybody complains about it?
Yeah.
They same. Do it with their bourbons.
I mean, unless if your favorite artist is Whatever We Got Left, I mean, then, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But that's what we're working on. We wanted to make sure if there's something you really wanted, you had a good shot of getting it. I mean, part of me was like, we should have set up a Bum Rush fan club or whatever, and then you open the Record Store Day, the first hour to the fan club. But apparently, that's just way too much trouble to track.
I
mean, I'm all about it. I know one of the other employees is kind of about it too, but we all want to, but the logistics of it's a nightmare. But it's coming. We'll get it. So today we're talking about some artists that rose through the ranks in New York City by performing at CBGB's. Both artists also call another album on Apple's Top 100 albums list a huge influence, and that would be 1967's Velvet Underground and Nico, which is why I think we should do that next week.
Maybe with Bowie.
Yeah, with, of course with Bowie, because, you know, because I've got to have a fanboy session.
He will. I'll leave the room when it happens.
Oh, God, here goes Trigger. He's on Ziggy.
I'm surprised. I was stapled to the chair before with you two. I couldn't get up.
And it comes back to a half an hour later. Oh, we're still on 5 years. He really is going to talk about it for 5 years. Okay. But we are going to talk about these artists who are inspired by that album. And they perform in the same place, but ironically, they say they really don't influence each other. That would be Patti Smith and the Talking Heads. Speaking of a concert that I went to last night, and the Talking Heads, some local band covered Psycho Killer last night at Reclaim Arcade. For those of you that don't know, it was Trash Rocket.
Hey!
Woo! And yeah, it was a killer show, so oh, if you missed it, sucks to suck. But yeah, it was a good show. My issue is I just get sleepy at around 9, and the show, I was like 11:30.
He was a trooper.
Yes. Yeah, and I was literally visualizing time moving. So I said, maybe I should go to sleep.
He heard about a certain song was going to be played by Last Band. He's like, I can make it.
You stuck it out later than me, so.
Yeah.
I was like.
Real early birds.
So they asked us to do an encore, and it's like, well, wait, Craig left. No, I'm kidding. Why would they do that?
Yeah. But I will say this, though, the Talking Heads have made a bit of a comeback, or not necessarily a comeback, but a new following. Thanks to the release of the movie Stop Making Sense, I feel if someone was exposed to the Talking Heads through that movie, today's album is the one I'm going to give them if they want to know more. Because it leaves a little bit of the punk behind, I would say. And there's some accessibility to it at the very beginning. Like, there's definitely an A-side, B-side album that I like here. A-side's more like frenetic funk is the only way to put it. And then there's that slow sort of B-side. Yeah.
And going on.
What I also found amazing, and we'll talk about it when we get to the last track. There was something that I learned about that track today while listening, and I did not know. I mean, I knew, but I didn't know that I knew that I didn't know. It's a weird
tongue twister.
It's a weird whole thing that we're going to learn.
Stay tuned.
But that's definitely what I would. This is the album I'm giving them to start with. How do I know of the Talking Heads? The reason we did the U2's Achtung Baby album when we couldn't figure out what to pair with Joshua Tree is because that album is my entry point into rock and roll. It's got a who's who of producers. Steve Lillywhite, Brian Eno being two of them, who have both produced records for the Talking Heads. So the Talking Heads definitely got a new fan thanks to you two from me. Oh. So that's pretty cool. Craig, I hear you have a lot to add to this production-wise. And
in terms of Talking Heads, yeah. And this is Remain in Light. Mm-hmm. And Brian Eno, I think it's credit for like songwriting on the album.
He does that.
Yeah.
On a few releases I've noticed, yeah.
This is not my favorite Talking Heads album. I feel like it took me a while to come to this one. Obviously, it has their biggest single, Once in a Lifetime, which is not a hit at the time of its release. But I was always more partial to more songs about buildings and food and Fear of Music. But Fear of Music is definitely a transition point to Remain in Light, which is really drawing from African polyrhythms of Fela Kuti, who Brian Eno was very much a fan of. And I mean, it's just the best rhythm section ever with Tina Weymouth and Chris Franz, who are so close to each other that they're also husband and wife.
Yeah. It's like they should get married.
But
I mean, even the live band they had, like, for Stop Making Sense and stuff. Like, God, what a.
That's what I find interesting about the Talking Heads is they go from, I wouldn't say punk rock, definitely punk rock tinge. Like the song y'all covered last night, definitely there is some punk rock influence for sure in Psycho Killer.
Okay.
But as they moved on, like they never stop exploring different sonic ventures. Like you were talking about, like, you know, Afro beats in this all throughout it. There's another album, and I totally didn't bring it, and I should have, that came out in 2010. David Byrne and Fatboy Slim's Here Lies Love.
Oh, yeah, because I'm like under the
radar. Oh, my God. This album, how did I found out about it like 4 months ago. Apparently, it's a Broadway play. Whole thing based off this whole album. I get it. It's got who's who of like musical artists. Steve Earle's on it. Sharon Jones is on it. There's a duet with Tori Amos and Cindy Lauper. Cool. It is literally the most incredible record. Yeah. I mean, and you could definitely tell it's a David Byrne record. Even though it sounds nothing like Talking Heads, the structure, that's David Byrne.
Yeah.
Even though it's pop accessible, you could still. And what I loved about it was they talked about it is what would it be like if disco told a story? Or what would it be like if you went to a disco and were dancing, but at the same time felt like something moved you?
Okay.
And it was this whole wild, it's an amazing record. I know he's apparently very hard to work with, but David Byrne is a genius.
I think some of that tension was part of the making of Remain in Light. I was doing some research, and apparently Chris and Tina were in Barbados. They had recorded in Barbados before. I guess they were doing their Tom Tom Club thing around this time as well. And it always seems like there was a tension, a push and pull between Tina and David, especially. I think Tina does not get enough credit as
bassists never do.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think the fact that, what was it? David was also working with Brian Eno on a collaboration album, My Life in the Bushes Ghost.
Right.
So they were getting closer together. Mm-hmm. And I guess Chris and Tina felt like a little bit more distanced, but it turned into a really wonderful collaborative experience where I feel like David takes a bit of a back seat so that Brian can be more of a player in it. And then apparently there's no chords on this album, no chord progressions.
I heard that.
Yeah.
I didn't hear any either. I was sitting there thinking about it. You occasionally hear like an occasional chord, especially like Once in a Lifetime. I hear it towards the end, but it doesn't like really build. Yeah,
I find that Once in a Lifetime is kind of the odd track out of all too, because it's not doing the same. I feel like a lot of the songs flow into each other very well with those polyrhythms. Once in a Lifetime, I think David was pulling from a lot of like evangelist preacher type
for
stuff.
For sure, yeah, we're going to talk about that
lyricism
when we get there.
Yeah,
definitely. I think I've described the lyrics as sardonic in that particular song.
When talking about the like the friction and everything, I know they were the original three. Like Jerry came later. Where does Jerry fit in all this at this time? Like when David's with Brian, does he do session work or something?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, Jerry was in the Modern Lovers with Jonathan Richman. Before the Talking Heads, like early 70s. And John Cale, who produced the other album that we're going to be talking about, produced a bunch of Modern Lovers tracks that never got released until later on.
I'm like, wondering if it's like he's just doing his thing while they're in Barbados and everything. Because it's like, they're there, and I know they're all, they're a couple too. And David's doing his thing. It's like, what's Jerry doing during this time? He's just like in the middle, going, "You guys want to get along?"
Yeah, I wonder what his dynamic is compared to the other personalities in the band. But
you don't hear about him brought up as much.
Yeah,
and then of course, we do have Patti Smith, and I put her as basically a pioneer of alternative music, especially for women in alternative music. When I listen to this album, an artist that I immediately get reminded of who came out 20 years later, PJ Harvey. I hear a lot of PJ Harvey, especially on this record.
I hear Bjork. No. Bjork has time.
I'm going to say there's a couple of tracks that I could definitely tell Bjork pulls from too.
To be funny, but yeah, I have also heard Bjork talk about Patti.
Yeah, so I could hear that. I
feel like I was always comparing Patti Smith to Deborah Harry and Blondie, which is a shitty thing to do. It's not just punk bands with female lead singers. It's so much more than that. And
Deborah Harry.
But I would say that both offer something pretty important.
Just kind of a different path of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Patti is less about rock and roll. I think Lenny Kay is bringing a lot to the table in terms of just like kind of garage rock. She's more of a poet. It's the lyricism of it all. Blondie, on the other hand, is the punk band that figured out the formula to become successful in a way that no other CBGB's band, maybe the Talking Heads, definitely.
Yeah.
But
Blondie really did have the hits.
Yes.
Yeah, Blondie was the bigger hits.
Became a machine. And then one other connection that we can make, I mean, David Byrne is rapping on this album a full few months before Blondie puts out Rapture.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think I was looking at the fact that Chris Franz played drums on Curtis Blows the Brakes.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, it's like, around this time that hip hop's taking hold too, and the Heads fully embrace that. Blondie embraced that. Correct. Someone like Patti Smith is definitely drawing from before that.
That was what I was saying. I said calling her a punk rocker, it isn't. It's not wrong, but it's not inclusive enough to really describe what I think I heard with this album today. You mentioned poetry. That's another thing that I noticed. Dylan Jagger, 60s pop, Ramad, Kerouac, spoken word poetry, jazz. I noticed all of that. It was a really cool, interesting hybrid. There was an artist, and I cannot remember her name, that sent you a link to an album, Hodge. She's a jazz dream pop artist, and she put out a new album this week, another one. Not so much as the one I sent you, but it was this weird thing. And that gives me kind of vibes of this too. It was everything blends together.
Was any of it dark? You've shown me a few that I've
been... No, there was one. It was like she's like it's a picture of a she's got a blonde hair. And yeah, and I can't remember. And I said it was an amazing record because it was like mixed dream pop and jazz. And I was like, wow. But I also kind of got that sort of blend of some of her other stuff and the other tracks on that album, on this Patti Smith record, was sort of, it's jagged and it's not like traditional like pop structure, but at the same time, it's a very good, it's a very interesting mix. Again, you mentioned John Cale. Of course, he's formerly of the Underground, Velvet Underground. He's the producer. Craig, what does Smith Cale bring to the table besides obviously the Gloria production?
I was reading that it was actually a contentious relationship between Patti Smith and John Cale a little bit. Patti Smith said that in hiring John Cale, she wanted an expensive watercolor painting, and what she got instead was a mirror. So I think John Cale was a little bit too much like her, maybe, as a performer. And I think in retrospect, Patti has also talked about the fact she's not coming from a rock and roll background. And so I think she signed like a deal with Arista Records. Mm-hmm. She had full creative control. And she shut down John Cale a lot in it. But I think that's a great thing in the fact that she is, you know, putting her foot down about things that she feels strongly about. I think John Cale has enough experience to respect that. Mm-hmm. And he, I think if he had it his way, there would be like a lot more multi-tracking and like lush arrangements. Mm-hmm. I think they found the perfect balance of, there are some very beautiful like piano parts in all of this, but it also has this rawness that, you know, matches with that punky ethos
for sure. I definitely heard that. She's also got another memoir about her teen years coming out. I think it's November 4th, called Bread of Angels. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. So speaking of Patti Smith, why don't we look at her album?
Hey.
The one we're looking at comes in at 83 on Apple's top 100 albums of all time. It is from 1975. It is Horses. And the first track is Gloria. The first line that I have written here, not at all surprised this is produced by a former VU member, because to me this song sounds a whole lot like the Velvet Underground. A lot like the Velvet Underground. In fact, so much I was like, if Lou Reed sang it, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So what I loved about this particular track is it's a cover, but it's not a cover at the same time, because it's a cover of them's Gloria, but she's totally tweaked the lyrics in places. It's got that 60s pop sound that she's a big fan of. Jazz. I also heard a little bit of country in this one. Which that's sort of what the Velvet Underground was, like 60s pop, kind of gritty, a little country, a little jazz, all thrown
an amalgamation.
There. Yeah.
Like so, a cross section of American music traditions.
Yeah, but I thought the big thing I got from it, she tweaked the lyrics to say what she wanted to say.
And Them was a 60s garage rock band that Van Morrison was the lead singer for. And I mentioned Lenny Kaye. I think that a lot of that's Lenny Kaye's influence. Lenny Kaye was hired to create a compilation of 60s garage rock, kind of like one hit wonders from different bands. Okay. And he included Them on that, a song called Baby Please Don't Go. Okay. Kaye is like the preeminent like rock and roll nerd. He collected all of these things and put it on an amazing compilation. And between this and then later on in the album Land, where he's pulling Land of a Thousand Dances, you know, it's familiar because you may have heard Gloria before, but they're also making their own thing out of it.
I thought that was really cool because it was like, it's a cover-ish.
That's kind of stuff that we do.
So... I mean, yeah.
And the sort of thing that you cannot get away with anymore because you would be sued immediately.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And I was thinking about the fact that this is 1975 that they're recording this. That song must be like mid-60s or something like that.
Yeah.
So imagine just taking a song from like 10 years earlier now, like Uptown Funk or something like that. And
right. Start tomorrow.
The gauntlet is thrown. Yeah. Trash Rocket's going to... And then we will get sued because you cannot do that sort of thing anymore.
But we changed the song. It's not yours.
It is a transformative thing that they did with these two.
So it was a good start. For me, it was surprising because, like I said, getting into it, I was not expecting to like this record. I got to be honest, the stuff that I've heard from Patti Smith on the radio has never, ever been something that I'm like, okay, I need to listen to this again.
Is there a song that you've heard before and just your visceral reaction was like, no?
What's the one that the 10,000 Maniacs covered? Because of the Night. I've heard Patti's. Oh. And
Bruce Springsteen wrote that for her.
So I know there's nothing wrong with the song because I've heard other people do it. It's kind of like when I hear a cover of Pumpkins. Yeah. I love the cover, so I know it's not the material. It's Billy's voice.
It's a very melodramatic song in a way that I think this is less theatrical.
But I get into it. I think also the way her voice is presented on this album, too, is different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find it so...
jarring?
Yeah, there we go.
I really like the way, and sorry, I'm going to do a Deborah Harry comparison again.
Let's do it.
Yeah, like, she's all, like, sultry and stuff, whereas, like, Patti Smith is, like, squealing and squeaking and making
raw.
Yeah, yeah, raw is the word for it, and it's fascinating to hear that.
But yet, for me, I just, I was surprised what I heard on this particular song, and it made me open my eyes a little bit. Maybe I need to give this a second chance. The next track is Redondo Beach. I immediately went back to our Cure discussion when we talked about Disintegration.
They always come up every time.
Remember when I said that what I love about the Cure's Disintegration is that a lot of the tunes, if you take Robert's lyrics off of them, you don't know it's a bleak tune. Like, if you listen to Pictures of You without Robert singing, this is a nice, warm, happy tune.
This is a little bouncy.
Yeah. And then you read the lyrics. Holy crap. This song takes what The Cure does and shoots it to the moon. This is The Cure's Disintegration, misdirection of mood and tone on steroids. Because the groove is so upbeat. And daggone, you read the lyrics. Man, it's bleak. I was like, is this about like a suicide after like a fight with a lover? It's ambiguous.
There's a lot of ambiguity. Yeah. I was seeing something about the fact that in all of the lyrics, there's no gender assigned to any of the narrators throughout this. I think the impetus for it was that she got in a fight with her sister, but then it turned into this like lover's quarrel that ends with suicide at Redondo Beach, which I think is also like a kind of queer meetup spot. So it also has like a lesbian aspect to it.
It was such an interesting lyrical pull because I was like, are you mourning? Is there guilt? Is this a dream?
And it's so bouncy the whole time. It's kind of got this reggae thing to it.
That was where I was just, I'm following along with the words and I'm, what the?
John Cale also has a happy sounding song about someone drowning on his album Fear, Barracuda, which I think is like a couple of years before.
But I said this was, for me, was an even wilder contrast than even what The Cure brings. I mean, I guess you could say Just Like Heaven, but the girl drowns in the end. Yeah, she does.
But I will listen to it over and over and over.
It's like, But yeah, it's like one of the greatest teams ever. So
just like
it. But yeah, that's for me. It was interesting because it sums up. I'm not really sure. I know the lyrics are kind of disturbing, but it was. And that's, I guess, like, you know, Mad World by Tears for Fears.
Yeah,
I never knew that song was sad. And I was listening to that cover where they were singing that Gadgets. One. Oh my God. And I said, there's no way that's the words. There's no way.
No.
Son of a bitch.
Gotcha.
That is dark. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had.
Hey, sums up my.
Oh my God. So, but yeah, this song definitely fits that motif just perfectly. The next tune though, Birdland, if I'm hearing it right, alienation, grief, and moving on beyond all of it is what I got. And I said, it reminds me of a book of dreams by Peter Reich. And then I looked it up.
Yep.
And that's the influence. So it's like this.
So, nailed it.
I was like, reminds me of that of this book. If I was to learn that, that the song was inspired by this, considering most of her songs were inspired by readings, I wouldn't be surprised. Punk meets jazz, wildly interesting. And this is where I noted, I'm finding this album considerably more interesting than I expected. Hmm. I mean, yeah, I'm becoming a fan by this. But I remember listening, I'm like, this reminds me. And then I looked it up. So, yeah.
I think after Redondo Beach being like kind of a upbeat pop gem, despite the subject material, to have something a little bit more sprawling, a little bit more improvisational, you know, that part where she's like spewing, I'll go up. Like, it pulls you up with her.
But yeah, no, it was interesting for once. Like I got a literature reference correct. I was like, I mean, this book reminds me, because I like that book. So the fact that I could pull from it that many years later, like David Byrne did for the Here Lies Love.
Mm-hmm.
He read a book in 1986. Just all of a sudden, he makes an album in 2010 from a book he read in 1986. That's some ADHD hyperfocus if I've ever seen. I'm like, man, I thought I remembered random crap from years ago, but you know. But yeah, the next song. Okay, this song freaking rocks. It's Free Money.
Mm-hmm.
It's about winning the lottery to escape poverty, class warfare being discussed openly 50 years ago. Stuff I've been talking about now. The biggest problem, it's not, you know, Democrats or Republicans. It's, you know, the rich taking all the money from the poor and having you blame someone who's poorer than you so they can get richer. And that's all there. But that part where it gets just so, oh man,
intense,
cathartic.
Yeah.
I was like, oh man, this song is the shit. I love this song. The song was fantastic. 10 of 10, would recommend. That was basically what I got. I know it's not supposed to be my favorite song on the album. It's supposed to be Land. But Free Money was killer. I'm like, man. And then, man, but this is where the album also, like, you can tell emotionally it's getting really, really heavy. I don't know, because we're going into Kimberly next.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's about her younger sister. Apocalyptic imagery. But childlike wonder at the same time.
I wonder if that's the same sister that she got in a fight with, too.
Yeah, I don't know. Because it's protective. It's tender. But it's twitchy and intense at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's like nervous energy. That's the only way to... It's like when I'm like trying to put together a lesson before I teach, and it's something that I haven't done before, and I'm like, I hope it really works.
Right.
I get that same feeling when I listen to this song. I'm like, oh man, I hope this lesson works.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it does. If it does fail, it Crashes and Burns epically. Well, so much for that idea. We'll be teaching that. We'll be learning this again next day, kids. Why? Because I sucked at it. My bad. This was a dream. Fever dream. Another thing that I really enjoyed about this, and I don't know if you all got it. This is definitely punk. And it's rebelling against all things music theory. Because I feel that the guitar work on this particular track is super lively. But I don't really feel it connected to the melody or the rhythm or anything. It's just like, here, put it in. It works. Mm-hmm.
It's driving.
Yeah, yeah, but it's definitely where I started seeing that her brand of punk seems to be bucking music theory. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's like, oh, you have to have this, and it has to progress like this if you're going in this direction. She was like, the hell with that. I don't have to do anything.
I did get that overall in this album. Thought, as except we already know, you know, in a band and everything, but with writing, you know, like, oh, things to try out, because I'm always doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I'm in a band that a lot of people can write, so that's a beautiful thing, too.
Yeah.
You know, but like, what can I bring to? Let's try some different things here. Mm-hmm. What were all the greats doing? You know.
Yeah.
But don't rip them off, of course. But...
Or do. Yeah. And just sell it as your own.
That's right.
I mean,
Spotify, I got something to tell you.
That's why you have to look at like bands like Jet. That song, "Are You Gonna Be My Girl?" That's a totally original bassline.
No, man, tell it to Iggy Pop. Iggy Pop, right? Do less for like that. Yeah. It's like, wait a minute.
I've never heard that bass line.
I've never heard those songs matched up.
Say.
But it's one of those ones I noticed, even in just the ones we've been doing since we started this podcast, some of them do get me really thinking. Again, especially because we're kind of going into recording another album, or writing again. Like, mm-hmm. What can I bring to the table to change things up, try to make it stand out in this little town of Fredericksburg? Mm-hmm.
But this also brings me to another point, because I feel like they're all kind of related.
Okay.
Like David Bowie, Brian Eno, Patti Smith, the Velvet Underground, because arguably David Bowie's inspired by the Velvet Underground, and Lou Reed's inspired by David Bowie.
Right.
In fact, I believe David Bowie produces one of Lou Reed's albums, if I'm not mistaken.
Transformer. Yeah. And I think Bowie is constantly inspired by Reed,
yeah.
Pop, he's a vampire. He takes other talented people and
hear that, Billy.
Yeah,
but Billy Corgan, you ain't the vampire.
But then again, this is where I wanted to go with
he
it.
Did Iggy Pop albums too.
Yes,
Iggy is not on this list anywhere.
I know,
and I've got to be honest with you. I just got a copy of Funhouse finally on vinyl. Funhouse is objectively the most rock and roll record I think I've ever listened to from the 70s, point blank. That record is rock. Everything, because it's punk, it's psychedelic, it's this whole cacophony of structured chaos. I don't know how in the hell they pull it off. It's an amazing record. I mean, that record, how? I mean, and you want to talk about, they said, well, it has to be groundbreaking, or it has to change the way things work. The New York Dolls definitely had a copy of that album before they recorded. There ain't no way. Another band that should be on this list. But yeah, well, of course we already know. I feel like there should be a lot more punk on the list, but you know, my soul will always be punk rock. So, I guess we should get back on task because we were breaking up, and the next song is Breaking It Up. Break It Up is our track. I know that Smith wrote this song with a member of Television. Mm-hmm. I think it's Tom Verlaine, right?
I believe so, yes. Co-written.
Okay. Yep. And it's about Jim Morrison breaking out of a marble. But I'm not going to worry too much about that because it's a wildly weird concept. But what I like about the song in general, and I think, well, it's a weird metaphor for what the song's actually trying to tell us, because it's saying is not to get too caught up in what things are supposed to be, because freedom comes from the authenticity of your own self. That's what I got from this particular track. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I can.
I think I'm pulling, you know, kind of her poet side, the romanticism of poetry, and the romanticism of poets that are no longer with us, too. Morrison being one of them. She talks about Rimbaud a lot. I don't know anything about Rimbaud.
Just left you.
And I think Jimi Hendrix is also someone that she's coming back to a lot. The people that have she's recently lost in our culture, you know, died in the early 70s. So this is, I guess, tribute to her. They're on her mind.
For sure.
Yeah.
Some of those were only, what, 2 or 3 years?
Yeah.
Wasn't Hendrix like 72 or something?
Well, the last song she does, she recorded it on the 5-year anniversary of his death.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Okay, okay. So, yeah.
Elegy.
Yeah, at that time, a lot of these had just happened, or recent.
Yeah, it must have been really fresh, this, like, a hangover of the 60s, where not a lot of people are making it out alive.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the next song, if punk has a Bohemian Rhapsody, it's this one. This is a track, because it comes in at a whopping 9-something minutes.
25 seconds.
Odd for punk, because punk, 37 seconds is, you know, a pretty long song in some cases. So you get like a couple of the Dead Kennedys records are like, what, 14 minutes?
Yeah. Jello can get a lot in 9 minutes.
It's like, 9 minutes? That's 3 albums. So,
a big deal. We have a song under 2 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's like, but the whole thing is inspired by Wilson Pickett's "Land of a Thousand Dances."
Yes, it builds up to that.
Yeah,
it's almost got like a 3-act structure to it too. Yeah.
Also, one of the things that I don't know if she did it intentionally or unintentionally. Probably unintentionally. Book, I get another one. It's a messed up book. A Clockwork Orange. I get those vibes from it too.
It's got violence in it, yeah. Definitely. Crashing his head into the locker.
Yeah, like Johnny reminds me a lot.
Alex?
Of Alex. Alex. Yep. Yeah.
Like the ultra violence and all that stuff in there. I was like, if to learn that she also drew from that as well, I would believe her. Because I got that, because I said it was violent, sexual, and untamed.
And that slow build up to that violence too is just really masterful. And then she gets to that point, he gets the feeling he's being surrounded by horses, like a chant. I would be terrified to be surrounded by horses, right? Yeah. Wild horses.
I mean, it was it's a tune, and I know my big thing was when I finished that. I said this is probably the most original tune of the entire genre of punk. Period. I can't think of anything in the genre we call punk rock that sounds like that tune.
I got nothing smart to say.
Nothing. I thought it was a great track.
Yes.
We have anything else we want to add to that? Because we're at the last track.
I like that she does "Land of a Thousand Dances," but she does not do the na 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 part, which is so infectious and such a great part of that song. But I guess she felt like I can't own that.
Yeah,
I'll just list all these great dances that I'm gonna do to get out of this horse situation.
But yeah, no. Yeah, I definitely
dance my way away from these horses.
Yeah, it was just like it was so weird to me to get like the vibes that I was pulling from it, telling the story I was telling, and at the same time, like,
yeah,
this is such a wildly. I love how the song is so untamed, but at the same time has a
raw
pathway to beginning to end. It's a masterpiece, folks. I don't know what to tell you. I guess the last song is Elegy. That one's, I believe this one was written actually for Jimi Hendrix, if I'm not mistaken.
I think Johnny in Horses is also based on Jimi Hendrix. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I guess Jimmy obviously couldn't record it because, you know.
Oh.
But Patty recorded the tune on the 5th anniversary of his death. I didn't expect this tune at all from the prior tracks, because it's definitely like mourning the loss of creativity and energy. It was what I got. And it was like that slow come down from chaos, from everything.
Yeah.
Because that last song, like I said, it was organized chaos. But this is just so like, yeah.
This album has an excellent change in moods from song by song. Whether, you know, those really intense like Gloria and Land. But then, you know, Gloria is followed by a bouncy Redondo Beach. This is followed by a mournful elegy. Yeah. Mixing it up.
Yeah.
So I guess final thoughts on it. I got to be honest, I fully expected to hate this record.
A pleasant surprise.
Yeah, no, this is, I wanted to say, it goes into the top five records we've done so far on the list.
Okay.
Not Aretha Franklin. Okay, Aretha Franklin was like,
all right, that's his one.
Jeez Louise. Oh my God. Number two would be George Michael's Listen Without Prejudice. That was another album. When I got done with that, wow. Should have ripped that one. No, I did rip it, because I had to check it out at the library because my internet was down.
Hey.
And you all had it, thank goodness. So I was rolling up to Howe Library. I was like, I'll be right back. No. I just
get Hoopla, because Hoopla allows you to borrow any album.
Hoopla?
Yeah, it's an app that we have.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, new stuff, old stuff.
Well, I checked it, and it was there. Well, of course, the app wouldn't have done me any good because my internet was down. So I was like using my phone. Like, I was like going outside to get some connection. And I was like, please give me some. Oh, I got it. Sweet. So I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do.
I'm glad we had a physical copy for you.
Because I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. Because I was like, I haven't listened to this album yet. What am I going to do when I talk about it?
Let John know I'm talking. He's here.
I don't know anything, but because I've got to be honest, most of the material though from Patti Smith I have found to be like nails on a chalkboard for me. Not only did I not hate this album, I found myself really enjoying it, and I haven't heard anything else like it.
Yeah.
The originality here, and I can definitely hear her influence on acts like PJ Harvey, also not on the list and definitely should be.
I love this album. Fun fact, my parents saw Patty promote this album the year after it came out in Jersey. And I asked them if they remembered anything. My dad was just like, it was a great show. Oh, so, okay. He doesn't.
No. So, yeah. Well,
that's cool, though.
But I feel, in general, when we talk about important albums, that one should be in the conversation.
Absolutely.
It definitely belongs in a list of best albums. So, no argument there. No argument. So the next album has maybe my favorite track of the 80s, period. The End.
Girl, you know.
And they did it in 1980. It's Remain in Light from 1980, number 43. Well, I forgot to mention, first album I listened to it through Apple Music. I believe it was Lossless. I didn't check. This particular album, obviously CD. Because that was what I bought it on.
There you go.
There you go.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I don't know. I love a good CD. Like, especially if it's well produced. I mean, it's perfectly accurate. Mm-hmm. Born Under the Punches, The Heat Goes On. The first thing that I noticed on this particular track is this is him saying, hey, like, we get it. We're from CBGBs and all that. We're going in a different direction. Mm-hmm. If you're coming here expecting our CBGB Psycho Killer stuff, this is the wrong album.
Dang it.
It's not a pop track, but it's a departure from the CBGB stuff. What I love, though, is like Burns' lyrics are like this unhinged protagonist. I'm a government man now. that one really sticks out to me, that particular line. It's a funky tune. Guitar work from Adrian Belew, featured on two albums on this list now.
Nine Inch Nails,
the other one. King Crimson's not on the list. Like, guitar work, you know, not being... like him.
Aiden was the 80s version, so he's not Robert Fripp.
But still,
Crimson,
though.
If you're making the comparison to Crimson.
But still, though. No Crimson.
Crimson should be on.
No, no George Clinton anywhere, and I've heard him on
which
several
is
occasions.
Very odd. He did not make
I'm it. Sitting there. George Clinton's guitar work, like the solo that Trent plays in, Ruiner or whatever, that's straight up a George Clinton solo. He stole that. I'm going to be. I was listening to Maggot Brain. Trent, you stole that. That's not yours at all.
Pass it off as your own.
Stole it. No, I didn't. I changed one itty bitty part. His is ding, ding, ding. No.
No, but no, I.
But no.
It's that itty bitty ting.
Ding.
But this is a killer opening track. Yes. Like, it lets you know right off the bat this is going to be something different. And it's going to be something brilliant. It comes in at 43 on the list. I'd say it's one of the few albums where it needs to be on the list. I can think of some albums that I think that are better than this. But there's definitely, of all of the 80s music that I think of, I'm going to put this up there like with the uniqueness of, say, like an OK Computer by Radiohead. There is nothing. I mean nothing.
And there's a connection there. Well, I mean, there's the Radiohead name.
Mm. There is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a later album, right?
Yeah. But that was the only thing that I could...
Ducted into the Hawk and Wall.
I think it's also a connection, like, it is very clearly a 1980s album, even with the cover art, mm-hmm. with, like, kind of a pixelated, mm-hmm. their faces redded out there.
That is
the other cool. side of the album was originally going to be the album cover, these, like, warplanes.
Yeah, I could see that. Not... I could see that not going over well during the Cold War era.
Yeah. Yeah, Reagan's just elected.
That's the best time to do it. Yeah.
Red Scare, that's Red true. Plains. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, I could see why that might not be the greatest thing to put on the front.
But lots of synthesizers. Mm-hmm. And then pulling from this, like, 1960s and 70s Fela Kuti, like lots of different rhythms going on,
but
all
what
at the same time.
I find interesting though, Eno is all about layering.
Oh yeah,
everything's layered mm-hmm. here. But what I liked about this is even sort of a departure for Eno, because it is layered, but it's not necessarily synth layerings. Like you hear like real instrumentation,
yes,
layered upon layered upon layer, which is really really cool. And I wish you would do it, have done that kind of bit more with you too, in a sense. Put some extra actual instruments instead of, here, let me put this synth pad, edge you, play a syncopated
right.
guitar line on top of it.
I think Jerry Harrison had a quote that was like, for Brian Eno, everything is an instrument.
Oh, yeah.
And
the studio.
Yes. There's no line of demarcation between the band and the... you know, studio proper,
it's very,
and then the technicians.
It's definitely inspiring. Like, and I was truly gonna say, not to keep coming back to like band I'm in, but like hearing
please
this,
do.
Sport in the punches. And, no, it's like, oh man, no, it's like, and I hear stuff like this, and I'm thinking about like the fact that there's like six of us now. It's like I would love to get into stuff like just even in Born Under Punches,
yeah,
or mm-hmm. even just to learn how to play like that. We just even if it's we never play it out, we cover this,
yeah.
Just to learn how to get into that and all the rhythms and everything. Mm-hmm. But this is not about, it's about 2 hours.
But
I'm thinking about how to take things in a different direction.
There's a little hint of this on the previous album, Fear of Music.
Yeah.
Like, E Zimbra is the start.
I thought
you
were really about to say on Rock and Roll Review. Like,
Rock and Roll Review. So they were going in this direction a little bit.
It was already being implied. Hinted at.
This just really pushed it, and Eno becoming even more of a collaborator with them.
Oh, for sure. Because he gets writing credit on, I think, most every track.
Yes.
Isn't like how they see Nigel Goodrich with Radiohead. He's basically the sixth member.
For all intents and purposes. And then you have to look at... Nigel's producing pretty great records, too, though. Because you look at Beck Sea Change. That's another album that should be on this list.
That even for Beck was different.
Oh, my God. Because I remember... Because that was coming out of the Mutations and Odelay period.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember Odelay was a big deal when I was in high school, and I just remember everyone going nuts over it, and I thought it was the most ridiculous crap ever. Hated the damn thing. I still hate that album. Wow. It's still ridiculous.
Confessions.
And then I'm in college.
Tell us how you really.
I'm in college, and we get the Beck Sea Change album. We open up. I'm like, great, another Beck album. Can't wait to hear this. We pop it in, and all of a sudden, it's this slow, like, this is Beck? And then I went out and bought it. It's like, I'm going to own that one. That one's fantastic.
You did. You did.
So, and now I own it on vinyl too, because, yeah, it's great.
I was going to ask, did it show up at your shop? Oh, wait.
Yes, it did. And it sold quick. We had it for like a couple of days because someone else saw it like I did when I saw it at the place downtown.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, oh, mine now. But speaking of interesting tracks and weird thoughts, this is the next one is Cross-Eyed and Painless.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I ever heard this song, I thought of James Brown.
Oh, yeah? Oh,
but is if James Brown was having a panic attack?
Because
this song is definitely about paranoia, and that continues from the previous track. The line that sticks out to me on this particular one is "Facts are simple, facts are straight,"
which is him rapping.
Yeah,
in you know very clear fashion. I mean, he is getting a lot of lyrics in here. I'll pass over the lyric sheet to you.
I didn't bring my glasses with me.
That's
so
okay. It's so tiny and so dense.
I'm that going to just say, yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. Whatever you say.
It's like, yeah.
The funny thing is also these songs are not in any particular order. This album that I, on the lyrics thing, someone who bought the album has actually numbered it to keep track of what song is what.
They're not in the order of
no
the
they're okay. They're not that's put funny down
even in
the
CD
order.
They're not in any they're just randomly thrown in.
Yeah,
I mean to sort of match the chaos that both of the albums we had did they bring to the table. But yeah, this is a really cool funky track, and I feel like the first half of the album is definitely more your funky fast tempo, and then we get to the B-side and it gets to the slower tempo. I almost feel like Jane's Addiction tried to pattern themselves after this, because
with,
Ritual De Lo Habitual, even the album like their
Nothing
last
shocking. Oh the last
their last album
yeah
which the first half of it's fast, the second half of it's slow.
Strays? Or after that?
I don't know. It was the one in the 2000s that I bought.
Had like True Nature?
I listened to it like... I gave it about four listens. I was like, this isn't Ritual.
The one where... Is it the four of them on the front?
Yeah.
That's when it strays.
Yeah. I was like...
To go back to this whole facts rap, I mean, this is like in this fake news era that we're living
in.
Facts will come with points of view. Facts don't do what I want them to. Facts just twist the truth around. Yeah, it's
you know, it's
even in the 80s.
No, it's crazy. And then we keep going, the term chaos, I just keep saying it over and over in both albums today. And the next track is The Great Curve, and I said if ever a song demonstrated controlled chaos, The Great Curve is it. The Afro beats, the lyrics focusing on spirituality of a feminine force. That's what I heard. I really, it's probably my second favorite song on this album.
Mm-hmm.
Number two. Obviously, we know what number one's going to be. It's not going to blow anyone's mind.
No, I think you're going to surprise us.
So you're like, really? Okay. I'm
holding my breath in anticipation.
Just like trying to make me believe there's water.
It's like, yeah, water is wet, and this is your favorite
it's at
song.
The bottom of you.
Okay. But yeah, that song is. I just love how everything just feels like it's like not in sync, but it is in sync. It's just like Chris and Tina doing their own thing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, this album I love is how it builds to this great crescendo before it goes to the unsettling stuff, the spooky stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Great curves building up. And then, of course, you know, the next track, which could probably be its own podcast for me all by itself.
Stay tuned.
Because this is, yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, so the next track is Once in a Lifetime. Hey. I'm sorry.
Doo-doo.
This is hands down my favorite track by this band. This might be a top five of any band for me, period.
It's amazing.
I could listen to this song. I don't know how many times I've listened to this song. It's a lot, and it's never aged on me, ever. It's brilliant. And what I love about it is it doesn't sound of the time period. It's one of those songs that I feel, because it was recorded the way that it was, will always sound fresh and relevant. That's amazing. The televangelism, mm-hmm. and how he's sardonically saying, I don't know how all this stuff got here. What are you talking about?
There's an anxiety in the verses, yeah. and then there's a reassurance in yeah. the chorus that, yeah, you know,
oh my
it's
God.
Just flowing like water.
Yeah, it's just, you know. Say, you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here? Letting the days go yeah. by. Letting the water run.
That's
you're like,
every day.
Yeah.
I mean, the sardonic lyrics, yeah. full force.
It's a crapshoot.
Oh, my God. And Haj, I got to ask you, because you're a bass player.
Oh, geez.
The bass line on this track. Oh, my God.
One of the absolute worst I've ever heard. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, man, it's iconic.
It's actually neat and well-placed, and another example of not everything has to be about, like, technique or,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? Like, sometimes less is more.
Yep. Notes being expensive and mattering.
Did it perfect for this.
Yeah, it's oh man, this is just.
And she's got a great rhythm section partner, so they get
yeah,
yeah.
They're in sync with each other.
Yeah, like I said, I think
without
this is
Justin Timberlake. Mm-hmm. Sorry,
I think this is one of the best tunes by anybody of the decade we know as the '80s. It came right out the shoot, 1980, dropped this gem.
Not appreciated at the time, apparently.
Well, but
I think the movie helped.
Yeah.
The video helped.
Oh, well, the video's
yeah.
fantastic.
Now that became my
yeah.
yeah. Like chopping your arm.
Yeah.
The book David Byrne wrote, How Music Works, has
great
actual scans of his lyrics and him working on the lyrics, too. You get to see a little bit of a development.
That was a very pleasant surprise, that book.
Yeah. It's amazing.
You could learn a lot. It wasn't really about him.
It's like a little yeah. textbook, and
right.
it
that's
talks about, like...
It's even designed. Like,
yeah. How music was when, you know, it was based
it
on the architecture of
versions.
Churches for echoing and acoustics.
Yeah. I have two different colored hardcovers and a softcover.
Yeah.
I just keep it.
I should give it a shot.
It's a good one.
It's still out there.
Yeah. But yeah, no, like... I could do a podcast on songs like that. It would be that. What was another one? The Sundays. Here's Where the Story Ends.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one.
That would be another one where I could go on all day about how much I love that song. But I don't know if that wasn't recorded in the 80s, though, was it? I don't know.
It's right there on the cusp of
mine. Yeah.
The fluttering of the keys in it, too. I'm not even sure what that instrument is, but...
Or if it's some kind of an arpeggio thing going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could just be something looping, right?
I don't know.
Yeah, but yeah, no, what I just love songs like this that just never age. And I guess it goes back to, you know, Eno's production. And then I think about it when I think of Achtung Baby, going back to the album that made me love this band in the first place. That's another album that I don't feel like sounds like it's from any particular era. It's going to always sound fresh just because of what they did to make it. This song has that same feel. And of course, Eno being a part of both, you got to feel that Eno might understand, hey, if you do this, this is going to be something that's not going to be connected to any decade, any era. The song's going to stand up on its own
mm-hmm.
and be something bigger than what you think it's going to be.
And then subject matter. I mean, it's asking big questions, like existential questions about, like, how did I get here?
Yeah.
And
what, oh, no, it's a, this is... Shoot. Like I said, I could keep talking about this song all day.
Please do.
But I guess we should move on. This is the B-side, I believe. It's Houses in Motion. I believe that's where the B-side kicks in. And this is where it definitely takes a turn. We get done with the funky, dancey stuff. It's slippery. It's spooky. It's unsettling. The rhythms here. Now, this is what I found wild. They're staggered.
Yeah.
They're not like this straightforward rhythm.
Starring.
Yeah. Line. The melodies from the horns are just insane. And somehow it fits. But Burns' lyrics are completely detached from the music that's playing. Completely. Mm-hmm. And it works. I don't know. Again, you know, like, Radiohead had to pull from this. I'm sorry. Like, when they heard... There's certain things that I listen to when I listen to Radiohead. Like, I listen to Star People by Miles Davis. I can damn well assure you they were listening to that album when they recorded the last track from Amnesiac. I can assure you they were listening to that album.
Funny you say that. Hold on. Let me dial.
But I think, you know, Once in a Lifetime is the exception, but, like, almost every other song is jam-driven rather than lyrically driven.
Yep.
It's not like David Byrne was like, oh, I have a poem that I'd like to put to music.
Yeah, no.
They were grooving for a while and really capturing the spontaneity of those sessions.
But yeah, it's just... It's another one of those songs, again, Controlled Chaos, which is the theme of both of these particular albums. Like, it shouldn't work by every stretch of the imagination, but it does. And then it goes into Seen Not Heard, which is another one. Spoken word, slow, hypnotic, identity, insecurity, and image. And somehow he managed to do that without putting truck nuts on the back of his truck. Right. So the atmosphere, though, it's wild on this. But that's some big stuff to talk about in a way. But... Like, as you were saying, because it's a jam sort of thing, and these big questions, big statements, big things that we have to think about, like identity. Because isn't it something about he's, like, unhappy with the shape of his face, and he wants to change it?
Wow, we have the lyrics.
Something about that. I think that was the song where I was getting that.
It's got that, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, it was a... another track that I feel... If you ever wanted to have a discussion about, like, toxic masculinity or appropriate masculinity, this is a definite song that you could bring up in conversation to say, hey, this has been talked about for, 45 years now?
Yeah, it's talking a little bit about, like, how culture influences what our idea of masculinity is, too.
Yeah, no, it's... I feel like lyrically it's ahead of its time. I mean,
yeah,
that was what I got from it. Now, the next track is the one where I couldn't necessarily pinpoint it on what specifically it was politically charged about, but it felt very political in nature, and that's The Listening Wind.
Yes.
That has a very wild atmosphere.
It has a character named Mojikwe.
Yeah.
And he is... from somewhere, you know, an unindustrialized part of the world that America has come to colonization in a way. Yeah. Yes.
It's like I said, I can't really put my finger on how it's political, but it felt that way. It was emotive. It was eerie. It was also gentle. And I liked how it was continuing. Like, there's A-side songs and then B-side songs.
Definitely, like, kind of a mourning of thinking about what it was like before America showed up to, you know.
Yeah. Now, the next song I learned that I knew that I knew that I didn't know that I knew that I knew that I didn't know.
Oh, this one.
The Unknown Known. This is the one.
I knew, but I didn't know, but I know, and now I know that I didn't know, and now I know that I know, and I know. This is weird.
If you all want to chart that out, you can send it to our email.
Yeah. This is the one where it's
a
like
flow chart, please.
Only an ADHD person can understand the explanation. The song is The Overlord. Mm-hmm. Now, I knew for a long time that this song was influenced by Joy Division.
Oh.
Joy Division is the huge influence on the list. Not on the list, but on this song.
What? They were a singles band, definitely.
Yeah. Somebody singles.
Oh. I was about to defend that until, like, wait a minute, he was kidding.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the best Joy Division, we're getting on
it. Was a period when they would have singles that weren't on the album. New Order did the same thing.
Yeah. Yes.
Right,
yeah.
right. That's
but,
back.
I was like, wait, bring how do back. I take what he just said?
But here is the thing, though.
My new pleasures, man.
They had never heard Joy Division. Not once. They wrote this song based solely upon descriptions they were told of Joy Division.
Oh,
this is what
cool.
Joy Division sounds like through, and they created it based off of that. They only knew of them in the description, and damn, it really sounds like Joy Division. I was like, damn, you.
It's like AI.
Nailed it. It's like AI, yeah. Except the human element of it.
They're the more modern band. Wide
the Ghost in the Machine.
They never heard Joy Division, and they get called like one of the heirs to Joy Division. White Lies, remember?
Mm-hmm.
They came out of being a ska band, I think. And it's like, I'm like, no way. You've never heard Joy Division when I hear that stuff.
Well, that was what they said, that they had never heard of it. So I guess Brian Eno was like, well, they sound...
Oh, for a talking head. Yeah.
Like this. And it's like there's a pop element mysteriously buried in a punk element. But it's not so much political. It's more about internal turmoil.
Yeah.
I guess.
They got it. They nailed it.
They nailed it. Yeah, it's definitely about internal turmoil. It's dark. It's dreary. Not really punk, though, but, isolation. You know.
I guess but by this point, they're not even thinking about punk.
No,
as
that's what I'm saying. I feel like this is where they were definitely like, we want to move on from our CBGB's connection. Yeah. This was the album where they were just totally like, we're not the CBGB's band that everyone associates us with. So,
everyone's growing up.
Yeah.
I know.
So today's listens.
But the Ramones sound the same.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
a good way.
Yeah, the listens.
But the Ramones sound the same for a good three decades.
But they pulled it off. Really.
Yeah, well, like I AC/DC, mean, come on, man.
If you like AC/DC, they pull it off.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like there's a few bands that's like Motorhead. Well, what does it sound like? Come on, man. It's Motorhead. What do you think it sounds like? Yeah.
Someone did that recently with, like, what was it, two albums ago for Maiden?
Yeah.
So, you know, mine weren't Iron Maiden. You could buy it without hearing anything. And then they introduced piano. It's like, what?
What? No, yeah. It's like, and then when you hear, like, what was it, Satellite 15?
From the Final Frontier.
Yeah, where it opens that way. And you're like, that building Prague, almost Tool-like.
I thought it was like build. A throwback to Somewhere in Time.
And then it gets into an Iron Maiden song. But I've always said, if I went to see Iron Maiden, that's the song I wanted to open with. It would be a killer opening track. Come out, you could have an Eddie on the screen doing all kinds of crazy stuff, like lights going nuts, and then that crazy drum.
Should I say I was at the Final Frontier tour? They did open with that. Oh. Not the Eddie on
the head, yeah. Oh man, that I was like, man, that's like the best opener.
And now you wonder, how do you go from the Talking Heads to Iron Maiden?
Yeah, well, we follow along with my ADHD. No, you can figure that out.
That's what we're here for.
All right,
everything's connected.
But yeah, so. My final thoughts on this album, no band in the history of ever has
ever.
Been the Talking Heads. There is no band.
That
you can
true,
hear
actually.
Bands where you could say, I can hear influence. Like Franz Ferdinand, I can definitely hear their influence on them. But no band has ever been able to pull off what the Talking Heads
they
did.
Really do sound like themselves. Or
yeah.
Just them.
I mean, they're unique. Love them or hate them. But you can't deny the originality that they bring to the table. I'm even going to say that you can hear Byrne's signature styles on this. But even Byrne outside of the Talking Heads, you know, the Tom Tom Club.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's stuff there that you're like, okay, I can hear it. But there's not this whole thing like we get with the Talking Heads together. They're a unique band. That I will say is probably America's most unique gem, maybe ever. If we were going to say what band is the most unique out of the United States, I'd have a tough time saying someone else other than them. That's just what I've got. I've loved this band now going on 20-something years. This is, man, like, this is a great album. Like, what do you want me to tell you? I mean, it's on the list of 43. Yeah, it's about where it needs to be. It's that good, folks. You should own it. It's a definite must-own. That's my opinion. I know I'm just some random schmuck, but I feel like you should own this record. So I guess we should probably kind of wrap it up, shouldn't we?
Well, since we're talking about Talking Heads, I'll bring up one thing. When they did the remasters and everything to stop making sense,
mm-hmm.
why do you get rid of the beginning? You've heard this, where he don't let him say hi, because that's so, you know what I mean, just sums it
yeah.
up. I have a tape on play. They cut it out.
Yeah.
What the heck?
But I will say this, though. The remasters,
not random, like
the remasters of the Talking Heads albums.
They're good ones. They're doing well.
Man, are they amazing. And the same guy who remastered these is the same guy who's currently in the process of remastering the New Order records. It's done the same thing. They're really good.
Yeah.
Really good. It, like, one of the few Atmos mixes that I've heard where I was like, you nailed that one. But I'm assuming, as nitpicky as David Byrne is, he's not going to let some hack come in and just fart with his music. So so my guess is it met the seal of approval.
Yeah. And going back to the thing about the, you know, the riff with Chris and Tina and him.
Yeah.
Leading up to that. I'm wondering, does that, you don't, because you don't see this all the time. You know, there are other, remember in Stop Making Sense, it's like, when they do the David leaves the stage for a minute, they do the Tom Tom Club.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, so was he ultimately more like accepting? Like, okay, he wants to just do the Tom Tom Club instead of like intro music.
I think he probably thought the Tom Tom Club stuff was cool.
He just at the time, it was like, no, he wasn't able to say as much to you. Like, when, since they've gone back together to promote the 40th anniversary, that's when he's admitted, he's told Tina, yeah, I was kind of hard on you.
Yeah. I think he was always just driven and it was a control thing.
Because it was just neat, you know what I mean, when you're watching that show and realize, oh, while he's off, I guess, getting ready with the
suit
he's going for, that they did the Tom Tom Club. Like, oh, that was pretty cool, actually.
Yeah.
So,
beep, 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 beep.
Stepping in rhythm to Curtis Blow.
Yeah, it's random amazing how they went back in time to take Mariah Carey's song.
It's okay, get out.
How dare they?
You said this about something else before. It used to be a running joke. I can't remember what it was. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, so like I said, it was interesting that both of our albums are, you know, from the CBGB's era of music.
Yes. 5 years apart, 75 to 80.
And that both of the acts consider Velvet Underground a huge source of inspiration. And yet, neither act really call each other friends or influences. I do feel that after today's discussion, though, we got to go in a way that I not expected to go next week for the podcast. I feel because we did these albums, originally I was saying I wanted to do The Clash's London Calling and Bob Marley's Exodus. And I do want to do those together because I feel like there's a reason. But I feel that we definitely have to go in the Lou Reed, David Bowie direction. We have to have that conversation. That's another thing I've always wondered. What would it have sounded like if David Bowie and David Byrne
did something together?
That would have been...
Yeah, collaborating.
With Eno producing.
Oh, man.
That would be... it's like...
Wait.
Well, what does it sound like? You're just going to have to listen to it.
It says here they just unearthed an album.
Yeah. But apparently there is some new David Bowie coming out later on this year. Yeah. Apparently he had some stuff that he'd...
In the vault?
Yeah.
Older than it wasn't from the Black Star era?
I think it's like a whole bunch of just
he's got a stuff. Thing, kind of like Prince. Maybe not as big, but the vault.
Yeah. But, so I feel like because both of these bands consider that an inspiration, we should probably evaluate it.
It's really awesome that both Patti Smith and the members of the Talking Heads are still with us, too.
Yeah
I think Patti Smith played a protest last week, like part of that hands-off stuff.
Oh, okay. Up in New York?
In New York City. Okay.
Yeah.
Go Patti.
Go Patti. But I feel that David Bowie and Lou Reed... are two characters that we have to explore when we talk about punk rock, alternative music in general. Even though myself personally, I'm more of a Lou Reed fan than I am a Velvet Underground fan. I'm going to say the album we're doing is the one that I can take. Let's just, because some of that Velvet Underground stuff, I got to be honest, it's a hard listen for me.
That's the John Cale stuff.
Mike, that's a hard listen.
He's going to drone on.
Yeah. So, but yeah, well, I think that about does it for this week's episode. Yeah, you know, life's too short for bad coffee and bad music. For Hodge and Craig. Hey.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome. Welcome anytime. Come on down. We'll see y'all next time.